This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hundreds of scientists and experts admit it is too late to avoid serious climate change. The violent weather is here now, and the polar ice is going, gone. It's time to talk about it. Our first guest, Professor Will Steffen, speaks for hundreds of scientists and experts with a warning. Global warming may bring societies to collapse, so plan on it. Then to the other plague driving us towards hothouse Earth. You have plastic bits in your body, you know. Almost every living thing in the sea does, too. Oil and gas companies plan to produce even more as a way to stay in business when solar, wind, and electric cars take the market. Multinational oil giants with names you know and petro countries will still drive and pump and drill, and they'll still leak methane and carbon into a damaged atmosphere. But fossil fuels will be hidden in the waves of plastic everything. Carol Muffett from the Center for International Environmental Law explains plastics and climate change. I'm Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where the whole truth leaks out.
Is it time to talk about society crashing when the climate shifts? In December, over 250 scientists and other experts published a letter in the Guardian newspaper in the UK. The title is A Warning on Climate and the Risk of Societal Collapse. Will Steffen is one of the leading authors. Steffen is Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University. He directed major international projects, including the International Geosphere Biosphere Program and the ANU Climate Change Institute. Steffen is author of more than 100 scientific articles and papers. From Canberra, Australia, Will Steffen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, in your home country, you had epic wildfires this year, and I see more record hot temperatures there in November, which is technically still your spring. How is it looking for heat and fire this summer in Australia?
Fortunately, not quite as bad as last summer, but we're still surprised about how bad the heat has been. We're in a so-called La Nina phase of ENSO, which for us down here usually means cooler and wetter conditions. But despite that, as you know, we've had record hot conditions. We've had some fires break out. There was a fire in Western Sydney just a day or two ago. Hopefully it won't be as bad as last year, but we've got our fingers crossed on that one.
Well, you know, when I spoke to Kevin Trenberth recently, he said that he thinks that global warming now from humans has overcome things like La Nina and El Nino, and so that we will still see a warming signal even when it should be cooling, as you say.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're seeing here now, is that the warming from greenhouse gases emitted by humans is now, I think, well over 1 degree. And that's really swamping the couple tenths of a degree up or down when you get a La Nina or an El Nino. So he's right. We're just now being overwhelmed by the longer-term trend of climate change.
If Australia's become the fire zone in some years, other countries are becoming storm zones. In 2020, the Philippines and Vietnam were hit by multiple super typhoons. Nicaragua and Louisiana were struck by huge hurricanes several times. And many of those places will take years to recover, but before they can, the next big storms will hit them again. How long until a society cannot recover?
I think that depends on a couple of things. One, of course, is the increasing incidence and intensity of these extreme weather events. But the other one, which is very important, is the vulnerability of the society itself. Because when we look back in history, going back through hundreds of thousands of years, we can actually see societies which have collapsed, but others which have made it through under the same stress. So a really important area of research, in addition, obviously, to climate change, is how resilient are societies, what makes a society resilient, and so on. There's actually a very good example from the present-day United States, and that goes back, I think, four or 500 years, maybe even a bit more than that, with Native Americans down in the southwest of the U.S. And there were three different societies relatively close together, and there was an exceedingly long dry period. Two of the societies collapsed, but the other one came through largely unchanged. So it's an interesting lesson that we really need now to look carefully at how resilient our societies are, where the vulnerabilities are, because we are facing situations, and we will in the coming decades, where the most vulnerable countries, I think, will be really at the risk of collapse as they get clobbered, as you said, by these multiple events, more intense events, and so on.
Well, and it's interesting because even rich countries don't seem to be able to stop some of these impacts. We look at Venice, where over two decades and billions of dollars, they built a defense system against rising seas that were swamping the classic city. And they tried it this year, and it didn't work. It didn't stop the flooding of downtown Venice. So what if we can't stop continuing climate damage?
Well, I think what we're going to have to do is learn how to somehow adapt to it. But if we don't, if we try to deny it, or if we misspend the money in terms of adaptation and so on, we could get to situations where we're simply overwhelmed, not just physically in terms of flooding, in terms of coastal erosion and so on, but also economically as much of our infrastructure gets damaged. We've done some estimates down here in Australia of the cost of coastal inundation, coastal flooding and so on, because much of our infrastructure in cities actually lie on the coastline. And there are pretty horrific projections of how much our economy is going to be damaged later this century. And, of course, once you start looking at very large numbers or percentages of GDP that are going to be hit, that's sort of telling you that you could face a situation where the economy unravels and your society does have trouble, real trouble dealing with just the general aspects of life.
Well, I want to dig deeper into this conversation, but first I just want to check back with you about an interview we had in 2018, and it was about one of the landmark papers in climate science, I think, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. And my simplistic impression from that is there is a kind of shelf of warming, sort of stabilized Earth, as you call it, that's possible, and then there's a kind of drop-off cliff going to hothouse Earth, and that might not be survivable. Did I get that right, and where do you think we are in that progression now?
Yeah, I think you did get that right, and where we are now, I think, is we're looking at the Paris targets and can we meet them. I think there's extremely strong evidence now that we're not going to meet the lower target, 1.5. There's just too much already locked in, too much warming already locked into the system, plus the fact that we can't get emissions down fast enough to meet that one. So the best we can do is meeting the upper target of below 2 degrees or around 2 degrees. That would be stabilized Earth, I think, in our 2018 paper. And we don't want to underplay, though, the fact that that would still require some fairly significant adaptation measures. There would be still high risks. And some of the most vulnerable countries, perhaps in South Asia or Africa, could struggle to survive even a 2 degree temperature rise. So stabilized Earth may not lead to large-scale collapse. It certainly would be damaging and difficult to survive. But if we start triggering these feedbacks, and we published a paper a year later in 2019 analyzing where we were with some of those feedbacks that indeed led to the cliff in the hothouse Earth paper, and we see that some of them are already showing signs of instability. Obviously, Arctic sea ice is melting, and it appears to be melting at an increasing rate. The same is true for the Greenland ice sheet. That is melting primarily from the surface of the ice sheet, and that appears to be accelerating. We're seeing more instabilities in the permafrost in Siberia, and we're seeing increasing droughts in the Amazon basin, along with, of course, the direct human pressures of increasing deforestation. So when you add all this up, that's telling you that the Earth system itself is becoming increasingly unstable. We don't think we've crossed that planetary tipping point yet, and we don't think we will if we stay within 1.5. But once you start going above 1.5, I think the risk that these tipping points could really take off, that risk rises. And that's the one that causes the really high-level risk, not just to the most vulnerable countries, but to many parts of human civilization.
Well, I have interviewed hundreds of scientists about the severe risks from climate change, and until very recently, I'd say 99% of them attempted a positive note at the end, encouraging us to take steps to avoid climate disaster, things we should do. And only Utah atmosphere scientist Tim Garrett said a collapse of this system was inevitable, and he said civilization needs to stop anyway to save a habitable planet. Now, you and these other prominent scientists and experts say it is time to talk about societal collapse. What do you mean by that term? What are you envisioning?
Well, societal collapse means an uncontrollable decline in many aspects of a society. So when you look at past collapses, some of them can be slow and drawn out. Some of them can be very much more rapid. But a contemporary example of at least a partial collapse was what happened to the Soviet Union after it disappeared in, I think, around 1989 or 1990. And how would you define that collapse? Well, the economy went down, GDP went down quite strongly. Life expectancy for a while went down as well. There were food shortages and things like that. So that was a partial collapse. I remember going into the old Soviet Union, into Russia, just 3 or 4 years after that, after the Soviet Union collapsed, and with my Russian colleagues having trouble just to find enough food to take out and do some research out in Siberia. Also, it was very lawless. I witnessed a murder in a restaurant in Siberia, just as part of the everyday life there. When we went out there, we didn't know who was in control. It was either the KGB or the mafia. And if you got it wrong, your life was in danger. So there are a lot of examples there of what at least a partial collapse looks like. Fortunately, Russia has pulled out of that, but I think that period shows that even large, powerful countries are not immune to at least partial collapse. So again, I define collapse, and a lot of people who actually study this, as an uncontrollable decline in a society. It doesn't mean it's going to disappear, but it means that the economy is difficult. There's oftentimes health goes down, life expectancy goes down, and so on. So that's the sort of thing you look at. And obviously, the most vulnerable countries would be the poorer ones in South Asia, for example, and some in Africa. And the combination of the fact that they're already under stress simply from poor governance, very poor conditions, poor health. And then when you put climate change on top of that, those would be the first examples of countries that simply couldn't cope and would start unraveling and collapsing.
I'm not so sure it's just in the Global South. I mean, a lot of the things you just described, sad as it is, might be said about the United States today during this pandemic. And why bring this warning out now during a terrible pandemic, Will?
Yeah, look, I think it's just time for us to consider the high-end risks of climate change. It really doesn't have anything to do with the pandemic. If there was no pandemic on, I think we would still put out the same sorts of warnings. But I think a lot of us are concerned that, I think as you noted, we've been calling for action for a long time. A lot of people have been positive, hopeful, saying we can still do this and so on. But yet emissions keep climbing, temperature keeps rising, extreme weather events get worse, and nothing really substantive really happens at the global level. We're definitely not on track to meet the Paris targets. It's 5 years after the Paris Climate Accord was signed, and still no signs that we're even coming close to doing what's required. So I think, and also I should say, I think there's been a real reticence to discuss the high-end risks as if this will be too frightening for people and so on. But I think it's time we actually have to understand that if the climate system really gets out of control, we are indeed facing some high-end risks. We need to talk about them, consider them, and hopefully use this information in making better decisions.
Yes, various experts say, well, look, the media, and I've even had this in email, you shouldn't cover too much bad news because it puts people in a state of depression and then they feel powerless to act and they won't do anything. But I don't know. It seems like it is time to start talking about collapse in public.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the psychology is interesting there that you talk about. I'm not an expert on psychology, but I certainly don't view it in that way. When I see a really serious threat, I want to know exactly what that threat looks like, how serious it is, whether the risks involved, and what we can do to minimize those risks or avoid the catastrophe. I guess it comes a little bit from when I was younger. One of my main hobbies was climbing and mountaineering. And when you go up in high mountains, Alpine mountains or the Himalaya, you absolutely have to understand the existential risks that you face from avalanches, ice cliffs, weather shifts, and so on. You don't want to just get good news and say, don't tell me about those because it's frightening. Well, it is frightening, but you have to face that if you're going to climb the mountain, and you have to take steps to minimize the risk. So I think we need to sort of psychologically grow up and say, look, we have to look at these risks. It's important for our children and grandchildren that we actually do look at them soberly, get the best information we can, and then take action to minimize these risks. It seems pretty obvious to me that that's the way to go forward.
So even when we know climate change is coming and it's going to be dangerous, can we really make a plan to survive the breakdown of society? I mean, isn't the point being that society breaks down and things don't work anymore?
Yeah, I think the point is we need to do everything we can to avoid that sort of scenario. And there's a lot of people are now saying time is running out rapidly to avoid that. And this is really, in a way, the fork in the road that we envisaged in that 2018 paper on Earth system trajectories, that the fork in that pathway between stabilized Earth and hot house Earth probably lies this decade, maybe in the first half of the decade. Certainly, I think by 2030, we will have put ourselves on one of the other pathways, and it'll be difficult to shift. That's why it's extremely important now that people understand the seriousness of this risk and understand that the students are right. This is an emergency situation, and we actually do have to make the right choices over the next couple of years.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Professor Will Steffen from Australian National University. He's part of a large group that just published a warning on climate and the risk of societal collapse. How are we going to raise this, Will, in our community?
I think efforts like you're doing there, talking about it, I think people need to write opinion pieces on it. We need to get on the news media and talk about what these high-end risks look like and be very careful and ensure that we say, how do we avoid these risks as best we can, and impress upon people that we simply can't wait anymore. We actually do have to take meaningful and vigorous action on climate change now. But the important thing is there's lots of communication channels out there in this digital world that we can use to start talking about these issues. But I think the important thing is we simply have to talk about them. We can't avoid them anymore. We have to really make ourselves aware of what the high-end risks of climate change actually look like.
All right, you're hired. You can be a Radio EcoShock host.
No, you do that very well, Alex. I'm just saying we need to have a few more people outlets and people out there like you.
I just want to make a mention of a couple of other signatories on this warning letter. Ye Tao was on Radio EcoShock a few weeks ago, and he was developing a very sophisticated equipment piece when he realized his invention might never be used because of climate-driven breakdown. And so now he's working on reflective mirrors to help our energy imbalance. Another signatory, Professor Alan Jones, caught my eye. He led a study using the DAW Global Food Security Model. That showed civilization will collapse by 2040 due to catastrophic food shortages. So his paper was Global Food Security and Food Riots, an agent-based modeling approach. So I'm wondering, Will, how do you think scientific research and public policy should change to account for possible breakdowns in the Anthropocene?
You know, I think we've got a couple of challenges there. One is the fact that our present governance systems don't like to look at those sort of scenarios, and I think partly that's because of most governments around the world are either explicitly or implicitly support a neoliberal economic system which argues for continued growth as if the planet is infinite and can keep supporting that. The second thing I think is the time scale is that most governments are operating on shorter time scales. They're operating on election cycles and so on. Of 3 or 4 years, and that's why a projection of food riots and collapse to 2040 may not excite them too much, because in their perspective, 2040 is a long way away. And that, by the way, is why I don't get too excited about all countries now saying we'll achieve net zero emissions by 2050. 2050 is a long way off. It's actually very short in terms of the stuff I do, but in terms of politics, that's a long way off. So a lot of those pledges, I suspect, are somewhat empty. So I think those two things really are causing us to struggle to deal with these existential threats like a collapse of the global food system and so on. We simply have to work out how we get these sorts of analyses out on the table and have ways we can actually discuss them openly and honestly.
Well, Steffen, what do you think about geoengineering, such as proposals to block out some of the energy from the sun?
Yeah, I think those are extremely dangerous technologies. They're a bit persuasive in a simple way, in that, well, if, if we have an energy imbalance, let's just block off some of the incoming energy. But we don't know enough about the complex behavior of the Earth system as a whole to understand what the side effects might be. So depending on what's used to block out some of the incoming sunlight, that may affect, obviously will affect atmospheric circulation, which will affect the precipitation patterns, which means that one country may have its rainfall stolen by another country that's putting up aerosols into the atmosphere, for example. And another thing, if that's all we do and keep pouring CO2 in the atmosphere, that's going to continue to acidify the ocean and eventually really degrade the marine biosphere. Third thing I will say is that the Earth is a complex system. This is a very, very simple cause-effect logic used behind solar radiation management. We still do not have any models or any good understanding to really project what might happen to the Earth system as a whole, what discontinuities, what tipping points, what shocks might occur if we actually change the incoming, the distribution and amount of incoming sunlight. So I think it's an extremely, extremely risky technology.
But we know that we are heading towards desperate times, possibly as soon as 2030. It seems likely to me that somebody's going to try it.
You may be right on that, and then we'll certainly find out then what's going to happen. But the cure may be as bad as the disease is the problem there.
On December 9th, the United Nations released their new emissions gap report, and they say despite a reduction in fossil emissions during the pandemic, well, as the New York Times puts it, the biggest polluters are continuing to pollute. So what kind of conversation do we require to overcome it, even when we see this train heading straight for us?
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to do in such a conversation is really to talk more fundamentally about our present socioeconomic system. Because basically, I look at it this way. It's much more complex than this, but just to simplify it, one approach to dealing with this problem is to basically maintain the present system that we've got, but change the technologies to non-carbon-polluting technologies. Classic one here is renewable energy instead of fossil fuels and so on, but continue basically in the same direction that we're going. The other one is a much more fundamental shift. It's a fundamental shift in values, lifestyles, and so on, where, in fact, we actually consume much less. Economies shrink and then stabilize rather than grow. And we live very different lifestyles, ones that not only don't pollute the atmosphere with carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, but also treat the biosphere in a much more holistic stewardship-type approach rather than as a resource to be exploited. So I think those two human paths that we could take, those are the sort of discussions we actually need to have on which direction we want to take.
You know, I was going to ask you whether we should have these scary conversations with kids, but then when I think about it, really the kids are already shouting at us about this stuff.
Absolutely. You can just look at Greta Thunberg, the Swedish, young Swedish girl who started the student strikes and so on. She doesn't mince words about what the possible risks are to her generation. So they're actually ahead of us, I think, in saying, look, you're going to really destroy my future if you keep going the way you're going. So those are some pretty powerful concepts and words that they use. They're ahead of us in thinking of worst-case scenarios and their future. So I think we should pay a lot more attention to what they're telling us older people.
In 2020, we see that superstorms or fires or drought hit different countries at different times. Maybe we should be thinking in terms of collapses, plural, rather than one grand end to civilization as so many sci-fi novelists see it. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've always envisaged so-called collapse as something that we've seen in the past in human societies. And it isn't one grand everything falls over sort of scenario. It's normally the most vulnerable parts of a society or the most vulnerable countries start struggling and then hit their own collapse in terms of uncontrollable decline in terms of living standards. Oftentimes, access to food, conflict is also part of it. But these can spread. And one of the concerns is that in a highly globalized world where the economic system is increasingly globalized, you can get a contagion effect where when some of the most vulnerable countries start to collapse, that reverberates through the system and generates downturns and collapses elsewhere in the global system. And then, of course, there may be a point, a global tipping point, where that becomes uncontrollable, even to wealthy, fairly resilient countries. This is extremely hard to predict. No, I don't think anyone can actually predict this, but it is not an illogic or impossible scenario.
Some long-planned scientific expeditions did not go out this year due to the pandemic, but now as we're talking, I'm wondering whether some signs of collapse or severe economic troubles may damage scientific experts and efforts to study and predict as we go along. Do you see problems coming down that way?
Yeah, I haven't thought too much about that because I think the real concern is not really whether scientific research and efforts can continue, but with the general public and population and the suffering that they will feel as there are collapses and downturns around the world driven by climate change, interacting with obviously some local vulnerabilities and so on. So I think obviously we struggle in the scientific community to try to build up the scientific community in the developing parts of the world. When I worked internationally, it was always a struggle to get on committees and so on to get scientists from Africa, Asia, and to some extent South America. So already we have a large imbalance in where most of the science is done and where the expertise is done. And if those vulnerable countries start collapsing, then we're going to have problems, even bigger problems, working with scientists in those countries. Good example was the Soviet Union when it collapsed. I remember going out in Siberia to really what was quite a good forest research institute in the middle of Siberia. But the scientists were out pumping petrol and taking any menial job they can get because their jobs were completely eliminated because there was no money to pay them. So this is the sort of thing that you might see in the science community as you see collapses in some parts of the world.
We have to hope we can keep our satellite systems going.
Yes, that's true. That's an interesting one, too, because already we're seeing a gap in some of the satellites that go over the far north and that have altimeters on them. They can measure to a very high level of accuracy what's happening on Greenland and so on. But there were some budget cuts. Some of those satellites, their lifetime is ending and the replacements haven't been approved yet. So we're going to get a gap already, even in wealthy countries, in some of the data that we need to monitor what's happening at the poles. So that's a very likely scenario is that scientific infrastructure and personnel may suffer as national budgets shrink or are hit by other needs.
And we're heading into some difficult decades, and I worry for my poor listeners who hear you and I, and they agree, and they're learning about climate science, and they believe that this is very, very serious. But then they still have to get in a gas-powered car and go to work at a job that may not help the climate at all, but they've got to put food on the table. So it's so hard to bring those two personalities, those two minds together and be coherent.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what that example you gave really does point to the heart of the problem. Is that this is a very deeply systemic problem, and individuals aren't going to solve it on their own. We can do what we can to reduce our own impact on the environment, our own emissions, but ultimately we have to change the system to get this underway. So it's really important that we take collective action, that we get together, force change in our political systems, our economic systems, and so on. And that's the only way we're eventually going to deal effectively with this problem.
What are you working on these days?
I'm still working mainly on the follow-ons from that 2018 paper. So I'm working on tipping points, tipping cascades, that sort of thing, to try to understand how far we can push the Earth's system before it really starts to destabilize. So one of the ways we try to develop a guidance system for avoiding that is the so-called planetary boundaries approach, which tries to define what the state of the Earth system is and how far we can push it before we really get the risk of these tipping cascades. And we're just in the process now of doing the third major update of those planetary boundaries. So I'm spending a lot of time working on that as well.
From Canberra, Australia, we've been speaking with Professor Will Steffen, one of the larger figures in the international science community, in my opinion. And the Guardian letter warning about climate collapse was published December 6, 2020. You can find links to that and to all the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Will, thank you so much for spending valuable time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We are surrounded by plastic everything. Most of us know that isn't good for us or the Earth. Bits of plastic are filling up the land, sea, and pretty well every creature, including our own bodies. But did you know the plastic industry is a major driver behind climate change? And the fossil fuel industry plans to make much, much more of it. This is all in a report, Plastic and Climate, The Hidden Costs of a Plastic Planet, that was released by the Center for International Environmental Law, a nonprofit environmental organization in the U.S. We have reached the president and CEO of the center, attorney Carol Moffat. From Washington, D.C., Carol Moffat, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's very nice to be here.
Why did an organization focused on law publish a fully researched report on the climate impact of using plastics?
I think the answer to that is because when we first began to look at the issue of plastics and what we could do to confront the plastics crisis, what we realized was that most of the attention on plastics was going into the problem of plastics once they were all already in the oceans. And the problem there is what you're dealing with is a massive cleanup operation. And so what we wanted to understand is, where does the problem of plastics really begin? And that led us to, you know, tracing the plastics supply chain to its very beginning. And that's at the oil rigs and gas well pads, where the feedstocks that form plastics start their lives. And once we understood that 99% of what goes into plastics is actually fossil fuels, that led us to start thinking about, well, when we look from the wellhead through the pipelines to the production to out in the environment, what is the climate impact of all this plastics being produced, being used, being disposed of, and a lot of it either being incinerated or released into the environment?
Every country, as you know, on the planet pretty well signed the Paris Agreement, trying to keep the Earth under 2 degrees C of warming. Scientists warn even 1.5 degrees is dangerous on many levels. We're starting to experience that now. Can we reach those lofty Paris goals if the plastic industry reaches their goals?
Quite simply, the answer is no. I think one of the remarkable things that we found in our research is that at every stage in its life cycle, plastics releases greenhouse gases, often in massive quantities. And those quantities are growing. As you alluded, you know, in your opening remarks, we're seeing the industry invest massively in the build-out of new infrastructure for plastics. The American Chemistry Council has projected that the industry will invest more than $200 billion in more than 300 new or expanded plastic and petrochemical facilities between now and 2025. And if all of that infrastructure gets built, what it means is the infrastructure, the production of plastics would expand dramatically, and so too would the emissions from plastics. And if that happens, there is no way that we can keep the world below 2 degrees, and certainly not below 1.5.
Right. And we cheer when coal-fired power plants close to be replaced by solar, wind, or hydro energy. But from the sound of your report, we may be sort of replacing those coal stations with the emissions from plastics. Could you explain how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this was one of the things that was really striking, is that when you look at where the CO2 emissions from plastics come from, the truth is they come from every link in the life cycle. There are methane and other greenhouse gases released from fracking, you know, from fracking pads and wellheads. There is methane leakage from pipelines and compressor stations. And I think one of the things that was really striking about our research is it becomes clear when you look at the details that the U.S. doesn't even know how many miles of pipelines or how many compressor stations it has by an order of magnitude. And yet we know that there are methane leakages widespread in these systems. There are hidden emissions that come from the clearing of forests and the clearing of agricultural lands to build those pipelines. And the biggest sources of emissions for plastics actually come from producing the plastics themselves. The refining of oil and particularly gas into plastics is one of the most energy-intensive and one of the most carbon-intensive of all industrial processes, and it's also one of the fastest-growing. And one of the things that we found is even if you were to replace all of the massive amounts of energy that it takes to fuel a plastics refinery with 100% renewable energy, which is nearly impossible to do, even that would only cut the emissions from plastic production in half because the chemical processes themselves release so much CO2. And so when you're talking about adding massive new waves of plastic infrastructure to the economy and to the environment, what we found was it was the equivalent of adding hundreds of new coal-fired power plants to the environment at the same time. Between now and 2030, if we continue on our current trajectory, emissions from plastic production and use and disposal would be equivalent to 295 coal plants. If you look out to 2050, it becomes 615 coal plants operating 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And what's really, I think, one of the really surprising things in our research is that those emissions from plastics don't stop once the plastic reaches the end of its usable life. Plastics release greenhouse gases when they're released into the environment, and they release greenhouse gases when they're incinerated, as more and more plastics are. Just the incineration of plastics alone between now and 2050 could add 4 gigatons of carbon to the atmosphere.
But I worked with a lot of activists at Greenpeace USA in the Toxics campaign, for example, and there learned a lot about plastics and what happens when you burn them and incinerate them in particular, all the terrible things that come out for our health.
Yeah, exactly. And we have a companion report to our plastics and climate report on plastics and health. And one of the things it actually talks about is the human health impacts, both of plastic production and of incineration.
What's the name of that report?
It's called The Hidden Cost of Plastic, Plastic and Health. And when you combine that 4 gigatons from incineration with the massive amounts of carbon emitted by the production of plastics, what you get is 56 gigatons of carbon. It's hard to understand these figures, but to put that number in perspective, 56 gigatons of carbon is equal to about 13% of the Earth's entire remaining carbon budget if we're going to stay below 1.5 degrees. 13% of our entire remaining carbon budget for the planet just to produce plastics. And so that's why we can say with such confidence that if the industry succeeds in its plan, there is no way we can succeed in keeping the Earth below 1.5 degrees.
Well, you may be wondering, why would I call you up about this report a year after it came out? And the answer is I was stimulated by an article that I read December 2nd, 2020, in the Barents Observer, of all places. That's based in Scandinavia. So journalist Atle Stahlson worked under this headline, "The Great Global Energy Shift Could Push Moscow Towards Plastics Production on Arctic Tundra. Russia's powerful petroleum industry feels a mounting pressure from alternative energy sources, and strong voices now say the country's vast natural gas resources in the Arctic should be used in petrochemical production," end quote. Now, that smells to me like an end run around what we're trying to do for climate change, a game plan for big fossil fuel producers to keep drilling even as we try to slash emissions from the power sector. Now they'll just sell it and embed it as plastics instead. And as your report outlines, that's another disaster.
I think that's exactly right. And what you described for Russia is precisely what we've seen other carbon majors companies doing, other big oil and gas companies doing. I think I mentioned that 99% of what goes into plastics is actually fossil fuels. And one consequence of that, and one thing that most people don't recognize, is that many of the biggest producers of plastics and plastic feedstocks are oil and gas companies. Exxon, Chevron, Shell, Total, ConocoPhillips. These are names that you think of when you think of oil, gas, and climate change, and they are the same names that you should think of when you're thinking about climate change. And what you described for Russia is precisely what we've seen with respect to the major oil and gas companies. They've seen that there is no long-term future in oil, and the promise of natural gas as a future energy supply is quickly vanishing, even if the companies are telling a different story. And so if you actually look at the companies' business plans, what you find again and again is they are looking to offset those lost sales of oil and gas by increasing their investments in plastics and other petrochemicals. The idea is precisely, you know, our products have to go somewhere. If they can't go into fueling cars and fueling power plants, we'll bury them in plastic. And the problem with that is not only that it contributes to the plastics crisis, but it simultaneously contributes to the climate crisis and helps companies prop up business models that are fundamentally incompatible with a safe climate.
So plastic is really everything that we get. It's made out of these little beads that are all glued together to make whatever shape we have, whether it's a toy gun or anything, a plastic bag for our groceries. And then it gets out into the environment and these microbeads break down. I've read about marine animals that mistake microbeads of plastic for fish eggs and they eat that. And we have birds with their stomachs full of plastic and all that. But does this plasticized landscape continue to release some of those fossil fuels, if you will, back into the atmosphere as they degrade? Do we know that?
It absolutely does. Research done out of the University of Hawaii that we discussed in our report found that as plastics break down in the environment, they off-gas methane and other fossil fuels on a more or less continuous basis. And I think this is important because the sheer volume of microplastics in the environment is staggeringly difficult to quantify. There are, you know, the most recent estimate is that there are 57 trillion particles of microplastics just floating at the Earth's surface. But those 57 trillion microparticles represent less than 1% of a single year's emissions of plastics. And the researchers at the University of Hawaii also found that even as plastics are emitting greenhouse gases while they sit at the ocean surface, plastics that are sitting on beaches, on shorelines, on agricultural lands are exposed to more sunlight and they're emitting greenhouse gases at an even faster rate. And unfortunately, you know, I wish I could tell you that was the biggest climate impact from microplastics, but our research suggests that it's not. There is an emerging body of research that looks at how the accumulating microplastics in the ocean are affecting phytoplankton and zooplankton. These are the microscopic plants and microscopic animals that form the very foundation of oceanic food systems and ultimately play a big part in human food systems as well. But in addition to being a critical part of food webs, phytoplankton and zooplankton play an essential role in the ocean's function as an oceanic carbon sink. A huge portion of the greenhouse gases that humans have emitted over time are actually stored safely away in the oceans, in the deep ocean waters where they can't interact with the atmosphere. So, but for that oceanic carbon sink, climate change would be even worse than it is now. And a key way that that oceanic carbon sink functions is that phytoplankton floating at the ocean surface fix carbon into a biological form, and then zooplankton eat the phytoplankton, and when they die, they sink to the ocean bottom, and that carbon is locked away. But what we're finding, what scientists have found in every ocean basin where they looked, whether it's off the coast of China, or off the coast of India, or off the coast of Kenya, or off the coast of Oregon, is that microplastics are being ingested by phytoplankton and zooplankton alike. And when they're ingested by phytoplankton, they reduce their ability to photosynthesize and absorb carbon. And when they're ingested by zooplankton, for many zooplankton species, they're making the species eat less, they're making them reproduce less effectively, and they're making them die sooner. And so what is the effect of all of this accumulating plastic on that oceanic carbon pump? We simply don't know. But the scale of the risk is profound, and I think that was one of the most chilling conclusions from our report, is there's this massive experiment going on in our oceans that we don't know the outcome from, and that experiment will just accelerate as we add more and more microplastics to the ocean.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Carol Muffett, as we said, you lead a law-based nonprofit, the Center for International Environmental Law. Do you see legal avenues to rein in the coming wave of plastic production and consumption to save our climate hopes?
I think there are a number of legal avenues to address these problems, and that's ultimately what brought us to this work. You know, CL has been very active, for instance, in working to build international legal responses to the plastics crisis. Last year, parties to the Basel Convention on Transboundary Waste added plastics to a list of restricted wastes under that convention, making it fundamentally harder for people to ship plastic waste to places where it can't be managed properly. We are also working with groups around the world and within the United Nations to get the UN to launch a new set of negotiations to develop a global plastics convention. And that, too, will help us address the problem of plastics globally. But a lot of the fight against the plastic buildout is going on one plant at a time. And here we see, you know, we see a lot of promise. I think the most recent evidence of this is with communities in St. James Parish, Louisiana, who are facing the buildout of a massive plastic plant proposed by Formosa Plastics. Those communities, supported by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the Center for Biological Diversity, have been incredibly effective at forcing the plant to defend its permits and forcing the government to recognize that many of the permits were granted improperly. And I think this brings me to maybe a more hopeful note, which is because plastics is so deeply linked to the economics of oil and gas, what we've seen is that the pandemic crisis has really fundamentally accelerated the shift away from oil and gas in many economies. And the plastic and petrochemical companies who had been betting on a future filled with cheap oil and cheap natural gas are now finding that the economics of these plastic plants may simply not make sense anymore. And that itself opens up a whole new realm of legal strategies where we look at our companies assessing climate risks. Are they disclosing them to workers? Are they disclosing them to investors? And so the answer is there are a number of legal strategies to address this crisis. And the key, you know, I think the key thing is not to rely on any one legal tool when our toolkit is so large.
Your report also recommends a transition to zero waste communities. The Zero Waste International Alliance exists. There is a branch here in Canada. I found listings of cities in several parts of the world with zero waste as a goal. These include Vancouver, Canada, Austin, Texas, and San Francisco. But so far, I have not found a real zero-waste community in 2020. Can that be done as a single city in a sea of plastics all around?
It can actually be done. And if you watch the film, the documentary film, The Story of Plastics, there is a long interview with a Filipino community leader named Froilan Great. And Froilan led his community to develop a true zero-waste community in one of the countries that's really at the epicenter of the plastics crisis. And they were able to do it in ways that actually reduced their overall cost of waste management dramatically and became a true zero-waste city. Now, ultimately, they identified there are small quantities of waste that they just weren't able to eliminate and just weren't able to manage properly. And it's precisely those sorts of plastics for which companies should truly be held accountable. We're seeing a big rise in many parts of the global south in communities and cities and countries being pushed to accept what are called plastic sachets, which are layers and layers of plastic combined with metal, combined with paper, combined with inks, in ways that make them truly and completely unrecyclable. And I think it speaks to the fundamental importance in any strategy based on zero waste communities of recognizing that getting to true zero waste is going to require not only changes in consumer behaviors and changes in how communities are operating, but holding companies accountable for the sort of packaging they're producing.
Yes, we're sorting out our plastics in our recycling bins here in my community, and we were shipping it all to China for them to figure it out. And now that has been stopped by the Chinese. They don't want to be the world's dump. And as far as I know, right now, our local plastics are going into a landfill. People were talking about making plastic picnic benches, but that really never went anywhere. I just don't see a good way for recycling to work. And then we hear about biodegradable plastic. Is that a good solution? Is there a green way to make and use plastic?
So first on recycling, you're exactly right. I mean, the truth is there's no way to recycle our way out of the plastics crisis. And the experience with China is evidence of that. You know, what was going on with China for decades was that Canada and the United States and many European countries and even Japan were effectively hiding their plastic waste problems by shipping that problem to China. And then ironically, when plastic pollution was showing up in the environment, in the seas around China and the Philippines and Indonesia, they were pointing to Asia and saying, look, the plastic problem is all about Asia. But in fact, the plastic problem was us shipping our plastic problem to other countries and forcing them to deal with it. Now, with respect to bioplastics, I think one of the things to bear in mind is that, first of all, something that can be a bioplastic and nonetheless be in every real sense plastics, which means it behaves in the environment just like any other plastic, then it's no better for the environment. One of the other challenges with bioplastics is that many companies, you know, combine a small amount of biological material with a large amount of fossil-based plastics, and they label the resulting container as containing bioplastics, which is technically true, but nonetheless profoundly misleading. And so what we see with bioplastics is it is as much a marketing ploy as it is a real solution to the plastic crisis. There's a very small category of bioplastics that are both truly 100% bioplastics and are also effectively and easily biodegradable. But those products are currently the exception rather than the rule. And so it's really important to recognize that bioplastics, you know, can contribute to a solution, but the real solution is going to be in reducing the amount of plastics we produce in the first place.
Carol, if you had a good connection directly into the new Biden-Harris administration in the U.S., what would you advise them to do about plastics and climate?
Well, that's an easy one because just yesterday, more than 500 organizations actually released the president's plastic action plan. And Yaciel was one of many contributors to that plan. And it includes a number of common sense measures that the Biden administration can take. Rejoining the Paris Agreement is one of them. Reinstating the crude oil export ban, which, in addition to driving the climate crisis, contributes to the plastic crisis. Instating much more stringent requirements for the permitting of new plastic production facilities. Ending subsidies for fossil fuels and plastic production. In other words, there are a whole range, and critically, joining the global community in negotiating a new plastics agreement. So there are a whole range of steps that a Biden administration could take to actually turn the U.S. from an obstruction in responding to the plastics crisis to an ally.
Where can we find that new plan, and where can we find your report on plastic and climate?
The best place to find that new plan, CL has it on its own website, but the easiest place is actually to go to the Center for Biological Diversity's website and look for President's Plastic Action Plan, and you can find it there. You can find CL's plastic work, including our report on the climate, at our website, www.ciel.org.
We've been speaking with lawyer and longtime environmental activist Carol Muffett. He is president and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law. You can find a link to their website and the report and the things we've been talking about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Carol, thank you for taking the time to help us out on this.
Alex, it was truly a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
Do you wonder how so many people can deny climate change is real or try to clean up after the seventh flood? Check out my show, Climate Denial is Human, with medical researcher Ajit Varkey. He makes denial make sense. I'll put a link to it in this week's Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Radio EcoShock is the weekly science-based program that is broadcast by nonprofit stations in five countries, over 100 stations, and it's out around the world by the Internet. I want to thank you for hanging in there through a tough year, in reality, right here. I could not keep producing this program without your support, and listeners like you came through. I'll be back right at the start of 2021 with special guests like Dr. Michael Mann and Dr. Ben Santer. Next week, I will replay my 2018 interview with Professor Will Steffen on one of the most consequential science papers ever, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. As we heard in this show, we have 5 years, maybe 10, before our emissions commit us to a stabilized Earth where life is hard. Or hothouse Earth, which may not be viable. That doesn't mean life could end in 2030. It just means by then we will know what road we are on. Which road we take is still up to us now in the last of 2020. But remember, you are not alone. Be kind to yourself and people around you. Stay safe, stay strong, and let's keep going. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.